And welcome everyone to our discussion today, which is I've entitled The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Daters. So it is a discussion on dating, but really any discussion on dating, my friends, ultimately is a discussion on marriage. Because for us, the Jewish people, when we date, what we're meant to be doing, obviously, is trying to figure out as best we can. And that's going to be a struggle and a challenge. And anyone who's involved in dating or guiding other people, or have children or grandchildren who are in the world of dating, can know that navigating this period of life, of trying to establish whether the person you are dating is going to become your future partner, is difficult. I spend a lot of time as a rabbi and a counselor working with young couples, helping them navigate this period. And over the years, I've put down, I mean, I could speak for hours on this, but you people have a lot to do, and so do I. I put down 7 things that I think stand out above all others when it comes to establish whether this is the person I want to spend the rest of my life with. And that's an important expression, because I've performed over 150 chuppas. I've yet to stand under a chuppah, my friends, with anyone who's ever said to me, Rabbi, I cannot wait for this marriage to last 1 year. You know what? We'll do 1 year and I'm just going to move on. Or 5 years, or even 10 years. We all hope and pray that the person we are standing under the chuppah with is going to be with us, God willing, for the rest of our lives. So how do we figure that out? What are some of the things we can implement to discover whether this person is meant to be my life partner? Well, interestingly enough, the Torah itself gives us dating advice. I know it's hard to believe that. Most people are not aware of it. And it appears very much in the Torah, in the early part of the Torah. Some people consider the mitzvah to have children and obviously get married as the first mitzvah in the Torah. And the Torah says what you're looking for. Imagine dating advice in the Torah, in Bereshit. You're looking for your Ezer Kenegdo. That is what the Torah itself explains to us, is what you're looking for in a life partner. Those are two very unusual words, Ezer, Kenegdo. I mean, they're opposites. Ezer means a helper. Kenegdo means opposite, almost against you. Well, that doesn't make sense. Either you're with me or you're against me. And the rabbis explain this in a few ways. First of all, how do you help someone, or more importantly, how do you help yourself by finding someone who's going to oppose you? Just like physically, if you want to build muscle, you need to have weights, and those weights have to give you opposition. They've got to be heavy. There's got to be resistance. When you feel there's some resistance against you, when you feel as though there is growth potential in this relationship, then you know you're on the right track. I know many people, all of us, are looking for the easy way out. Someone is always going to be happy with us. You know, I once gave a seminar on this. And I said, what are you looking for in a wife or a husband? And a young man put his hand up, a young yeshiva boy. And he said, Rabbi, you know, I'm looking for a girl who's going to be happy whenever she sees me. When I come home, she's not going to nag me or get angry with me. And she's not going to be on the phone with her family or friends. She's just going to always be happy with me and our marriage. And I said, you're not looking for a wife. You're looking for a cat. Unfortunately, we all want to have this relationship where everything is smooth, that everything's great. And unfortunately, a lot of these images come from movies, whether it's Disney, which I can talk about a whole other time, of unfortunately the disease that we've downloaded by watching a lot of these movies, that everything's going to be perfect. And we all just ride off into the sunset right after the wedding. And everything's going to be fantastic. Actually, one of the worst things I tell people they can do, Baruch Hashem, we in the religious world, what we are very keen about doing is spending at least 7 days slowing down, compressing after the marriage, having Sheva Brachot, which is such a genius concept. After all the excitement, all the buildup of getting to the wedding and preparing it and family and flying in, and then many people go out there and have a vacation. Terrible idea. Do not do that. You want to just kind of lock down, be around people, and kind of land the plane after that very intense emotional, physical, and financial experience that you've been through. Just moving into just being you and him together, or you and her together on some vacation somewhere, is not a good idea. Many times I've had to intercede during those experiences, try to calm things down. So you're looking for someone who's going to become your Ezer Kenegdo. And this really takes us to the main question I want to ask today, which I ask every couple who are looking to get married. And if you're dealing with someone who is, I would ask this question to them. You're dating in order to get married. That's the presupposition we are working with over here. Right? Dating as a meet. If you're just dating for the sake of dating, this talk isn't really going to apply to you. I mean, you can bank it in your cerebellums and come back to another time. But we're talking about people who want to date in order to create a Jewish family together. So the question I have is, why get married? I've asked this question over the years to thousands and thousands of people, and I've had great responses. Why get married? And among responses I've had to that question is, well, I want to find someone to be with me in my old age. That's fair enough. I want someone who's going to love me and care for me. It's good. I want to have someone I can have kids with. It's also fair. I've had the following answer many times too. I want someone who can help me share the rent in Manhattan because it's so expensive and help save money on taxes. Also, answer I've received many, many times. And I'm not judging. If that's what you need, that's what you need. I want to share with you a different paradigm, something else. And that is maybe we date in order to get married, and we get married in order to improve ourselves. It could well be this whole thing called marriage and family and kids and yeshiva tuition and everything else, that I'm buying a house and everything else, all the bills that comes with it, is not ultimately about me wanting to be in a loving relationship, which is all well and good. Or even having a family, that's great as well. But let's be honest, many people don't get married in order to do that. Maybe this idea of marriage is there to help us become the best version of ourselves. So I have found that many young people are dating and they're all looking for someone who can make them happy and have a good time with. And they'll say, yeah, I'm dating a great guy or a great girl. And we have some good time, go to the restaurants, and we go hang out, go for walks, and all this wonderful stuff they do together. And I find that it's all about me, me, me. But marriage is all about us, us, us. You're turning the I into us and the me into we. And that transition has become extremely difficult for young people today. Going from the selfish I, which we all have, and trying to turn that into an us, that is what we're going to try to tackle today. And so Ezer Kenegdo, these words of the Torah itself are telling us, maybe I'm looking for someone who can help me become the best version of myself. I'm not going to try to change anybody else, because in the end, it's really not going to work. You can't change anyone else. Then the Torah gives us the goal line, right? Where we want to be. So find your Ezer Kenegdo. And then a few pasukim later, it tells us, in order to become Basar Echad. Right, that's in Bereshit, Bet, Chaf Bet. Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. And they say, I'll tell you why. If you find your Ezer Kenegdo, you'll be able to come one flesh. What does it mean, one flesh? Basar, that's a strange, unusual expression. I haven't seen anywhere else in the Torah. Maybe it appears somewhere else. One flesh. So the Rishonim spend a lot of time trying to figure out what exactly does that mean. Well, one opinion is you have kids. They become basar echad, one flesh that comes from both of you. And that really is the mitzvah in order to create a vibrant and healthy Jewish family in order to increase the Jewish people. That's one opinion. The Smag, however, says something fascinating. And he says, basar echad means you find someone who becomes you. Imagine, he says, you're cutting a piece of meat. And there you are cutting a piece of meat in the kitchen and you slip with the knife and you cut your left hand. Would you ever see someone with their left hand slap their right hand and say, ow, that really hurt, why'd you do that? If you saw someone doing that, you think they're completely crazy. Or imagine you see someone walking down the street and tripping up with their right foot, and then you see them kicking their right foot with their left foot and say, why'd you do that? This person's completely imaginary, completely crazy. Why? Because I'm one person, I'm one being. Says the Smug, you want to get to a place where your relationship becomes basar echad. It's not me and you, it's us. Me shout at you and get angry with you? I know this is an ideal, but I'm just sharing it, what the rabbis tell us. How could that be? It's me. It's as nonsensical as me slapping myself. There's a beautiful book called Tzaddik in Our Time by Simcha Raz. about the life of Rav Aryeh Levin. He was a very, very much beloved rabbi. I actually took my kids to see the outside of his house. They weren't so interested, but when I told them stories, it got better in Eretz Yisrael. A very, very holy Jew. He was loved by everyone. His stories about him, he lived a very frugal life. And he used to go to visit the prisons, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And just there was a tremendous love for this rabbi. There's a beautiful story in this book about his wife who was suffering from foot problems. And he went to the doctor, the author tells us. And while he was in the doctor's office, he managed to, you know, he went with his wife, obviously, he managed to get in and sit down with the doctor. It was a very busy surgery in Yerushalayim. And the doctor says, "What's going on?" And Rabbi Levin spoke first and said, "My wife's foot hurts us." That was his response. And the doctor hit him and he wrote this down and it got put in the book. "My wife's foot hurts us. It's not her foot and it's our foot." I like this because it's a very, very good metaphor analogy for how we're meant to see life when we create the Basar Echad concept. It's not you and me, it's us. And this has become, I found today, extremely difficult. And Shalom Bayit is really the go-to term everyone talks about, finding peace and creating a peaceful home. A home of Shalom is Shalem, that is complete, that is whole. You know, we look at our great heroes and heroines from Jewish history, in the Torah, and in the Nevi'im as well, in the prophets as well. And we look at them, we're like, we see stories of their lives, but not too much of a glimpse is given to us to really help us understand what their home life was like. But there is an exception over there. We see from Abraham and Sarah. And the rabbi says that Abraham and Sarah, Torah tells us, were traveling and living a lifestyle of moving in order to bring monotheistic, ethical and moral monotheism to the world, give avodah zarah. And they brought many, many people under the kanfei shechinah, under God's wings and his protection. And they were very successful of that. You know, three angels, as you know, the famous story in the Torah, came to visit Avraham Avinu in order to do a few things, heal him from his Brit Milah, and to notify him of an event that was about to happen, and to tell him that Sarah, his wife, was going to have a child at a very, very old age. Before these angels, which the rabbis tell us they were angels, before they did that, they said, "By the way, Avraham, where is Sarah, your wife?" And she said, he said, "She's in the tent. She's in the tent right now, in my home." And the rabbis are like, Rashi among them says, "These are angels. They know where Sarah is. Why would they ask this unusual question of where is Sarah, your wife?" And the answer is because that Avraham Avinu, by saying, "My wife is there in the tent," would feel a love. "Wow, you know, you're right. Thanks for reminding me. I have this amazing wife who's part of my life mission. And there she is building my home. And we work together in serving guests and bringing people back to God, bringing people back to Hashem." And then the Chasam Sofer asks another question and says, "Really? I mean, Avraham Avinu at this point is 100 years old. His wife is 90. I mean, do they really need a malach, an angel, to come down in order to help their relationship?" And he says, "Absolutely. We think, they've been married for so long. They've been in this for such a long time. They don't need." The Torah is telling us that even Avraham Avinu, who, believe me, and Sarah men who had amazing shalom bayit, amazing peace in their homes, still needed strengthening in their relationship. That Hashem had to send an angel down deliberately and make him share a message with them that would bring them even closer. Basically, my friends, it starts, but it never stops. It's constant work. I gave a talk about 3-4 years ago at NCSY about relationships. And one of the things I do, I make it fun and enjoyable about dating and relationships, but I always point out that it's really hard. Dating is tough, but marriage, woo! That, my friends, is hard, hard work. And I kept talking like this. And at the end, a young girl approached me. She was actually an advisor at NCSY. And she said to me, "Rabbi, can I ask you a personal question?" I was like, "Sure, of course you can." She's like, "Are you in a bad marriage?" And I was like, "Why would you ask me that?" I said, "You keep talking about how difficult marriage is and being a parent, having kids." And I'm like, "That's a good marriage." My dear friend, that's a bad one. I don't want to even think about. I'm talking about a good, healthy, growing marriage. That's really, really, really hard work. So you better find the right partner. She ended up getting married, God willing, Azara Chuppah, actually performed the Chuppah. And she turned around to me a year after, and she's like, yeah, I get it. It's hard work, you know? I think the good analogy for when you first get married is like a new pair of shoes. At first, they pinch, they make you sore a little bit, but in a short amount of while, the leather starts to soften, and eventually, Baruch Hashem, things become better. Okay, so let's begin. So we're talking about 7 habits of highly effective daters. That's what we're going for. Ezer Kenegdo, Baser Achad, it's hard work, it's worth it, it's a mitzvah. According to Rashi and others, it's the first mitzvah of the Torah. Before you even get going in life as a Jew, we've got to think about building a Jewish family because it's all about the next generation. Here are the 7 habits. I'm going to go through them, all 7 right now, and then we'll double click on each one of them. Habit number one is find common goals. Become partners in fulfilling your life's mission. Number 2, work on yourself, not on your partner. That's a big one. Habit number 3 is realize that no one marries someone perfect. I have a lot to say on that, but I'll come back to that, God willing. Number 4 is, and this is a topic in and of itself, so I'm going to gloss over it, but it's really its own, and I have a few videos online already about this one. Watch out for an abusive person. Okay, we're going to come to that in a few minutes. Number 5, don't let your love be dependent on things. It's a Mishnah. I shall explain that as well. Habit number 6 is make a realistic list of qualities you're looking for in a partner. And number 7, and this is really, really important, appoint someone as your mentor. You cannot do this alone, whether you yourself are in dating or you have a loved one, a child in dating as well, you need a mentor. You need someone who's going to be there to help you. Okay, so let's begin with our 7. Number 1, become partners in fulfilling your life's mission. There was a Gallup poll a number of years ago of people who were divorced, and they asked them, what were the reasons you got divorced? Only 5% said it was physical abuse. 10% said it was arguments over money, family, or children. Talk about the money thing as well. The money thing, I have a whole chapter in my book on this idea of money and struggles over it. Not the lack of it, just arguing over it. 17% said because of infidelity, but 47% of divorcees attributed incompatibility. You want someone who is going to be compatible with you to help you create that mission. While we're dating, dating should be a fact-finding mission. Actually, and when I say this, young people get very upset, but I'm going to say it anyway. The last thing you want to do is fall in love while you're dating. You'll have plenty of time to fall in love once you're married. But while you're dating, you want to, as best as possible, and this is not easy, to be as dispassionate and as objective and as rational as possible. Now, we're not rational beings. We are emotional beings. Even the smartest among us, and I've met very smart people and deal with them all the time. We're not right. We are emotional. When it comes to dating, though, we want as best as possible to try to have as much clarity as we can. And young people today really lack clarity. There's so much information being thrown at them from so many different places of ideas and thoughts and images. And these things are not always so conducive to helping them find clarity in their lives. This big jumble mess that is constantly being thrown into their brains, unfortunately, leads them away from clarity. And many of them need to seek clarity from other people when it comes to their relationships. And there was actually a study that came out, which Reuters reported on, that says that many people are dragging their feet on getting married. The average age of marriage about 50 years ago was, I think, for a man about 23, 24. I have the numbers somewhere. Now it's 27, 28. For a girl, it used to be 19, 20. I'm sure you think about your grandparents got married very young. My grandmother was in her early teens when she got married, or mid-teens, I should say. Things have changed. Now, mid to late 20s. People are dragging their feet. People are very scared of commitment. And I'll mention as well, I have a few reasons why that is. There's a lot of fear that comes with it. But I've found, and this is the key, and everything I'm going to tell you today really revolves around this, because this has really become my counseling practice, people do not know how to communicate. They've lost it. Maybe they never did, I don't know. But communication has been lost. And in many, many occasions, young men and women, even older men and women, need a third party to come in and help them in their communication skills, because they just don't have it. They just think, well, I went to college and I got a degree, or I grew up in a nice family with wonderful parents. I got nice siblings. I led a, you know, an average kind of Jewish life. And then next is, well, just get married, because that's just next on the agenda. And they'll think they're able to just jump in. Well, my friends, having a spouse makes you into a good husband or wife, like having a piano makes you into a great pianist. There is no connection. And people really don't know how to communicate. They don't know how to give of themselves. There's a lack of emotional intimacy that exists today. And I always say the word intimacy is a very good word, because it's made up of different words, I believe, called intimacy. I'm not talking physical intimacy. Oh, that is its own thing. I'm talking about emotional intimacy. You have to open yourself up and become vulnerable, which many people are very, very scared to do, because they're scared of having their hearts broken. And one of the results is people are delaying getting married. They just are not willing to take the plunge. I will mention one of the metaphors the rabbis use, Chazal use for marriage, you may have heard this, is Kriyat Yam Suf, right? Kriyat Yam Suf, they say finding a marriage partner, actually it's actually marriage in general, having kids, is compared to the splitting of the Red Sea. What an unusual analogy. Why would marriage be compared to the splitting of the Red Sea? And now there's many, many answers to this question. It's a talk in and of itself. I have many different answers to this great, great, beautiful analogy. But one of them is, what made the sea split? So if you read the Torah, you'll see that it's Moshe Rabbeinu, right? With his matzah, with his staff. There was a wind the entire night before, and the sea was bokeh yam, it split. Actually, the Gemara tells us a hidden story. There was someone called Nachshon ben Amminadav. He was a prince of the tribe of Yehuda of Judah, a very great man. And the Gemara tells us that he actually walked into the Yam Suf first, and the water went up to his ankles, and up to his knees, and up to his stomach, and up to his chest, and up to his chin, over his mouth. He was about to go over his nose. The sea split. He is the secret hero of our story. What's that got to do with marriage? Well, let me give you one answer. And that is, sometimes you can overthink it and you just have to jump in. It's a position of faith. I know it sounds strange, but people think they need to be 100% sure that the person I'm dating and I'm going to be under the chuppah with is 100% meant to be my soulmate. I'll talk about that in a moment as well. And the truth is, you don't know. There's a lot of emunah and bitachon. Sometimes you just have to trust God, trust your advisors, and just jump in. That's one of the connections I find between Kriyat Yam Suf, splitting of the sea, and marriage in general. Do you really know 100%? Do you really know the job you're about to start is going to last forever? Do you know if the college you're about to go into, you're going to end up getting a degree? You don't know, but you put your best efforts into it. I'll give you just a cute analogy on this. And that is, if you play basketball, I was going to give a soccer analogy because I'm from Britain originally, but I'll give you a basketball analogy. I'm not very good at it. If I ask you to throw the ball in the net and I ask you, what percentage chance do you have of succeeding of getting the ball in the net? Even you're a good player, I don't know, from the line, maybe 60, 70%. With how much effort do you throw the ball? 100% effort, of course. Why? That makes no sense. If there's only 60, 70% chance of getting the ball in, then give it 60 or 70% effort. And the answer is, even though I'm not 100% sure, I can still give it 100% effort. And that, my friends, is going to be the key to your success when it comes to relationship. And therefore, there are certain questions. And if you want, you can email me. My email is hadjioff@yu.edu or rl@rabbilawrence.com. And I'll send you this list of things you need to discuss. So I find that people are dating and they'll date for weeks, months. I mean, I'm dealing with people right now who are dating for years and are not able to close the deal. And there's certain things you need to discuss as early on as possible. General issues to talk about before you get married, right? Why are we getting married? What do I want out of my marriage, right? Tell me about your family. What was your childhood like, right? Was your family an affectionate one? right? Self-image issues to discuss when you get married. How do you describe yourself, right? Are you a jealous person? Do you have insecurities, trust issues? I mean, it's a long list. I'm just giving you a few choice pieces. Discuss money, right? Everyone has their own relationship to money. What does money mean to you? What do you want to do with it? Let's say you had $1 million right now. What would you spend it on? These are very, very important and telling questions. Do you have a budget? Do you want one? Tell me, do you want to have kids? Right. Most people answer, yes, but why? Right. Tell me about your childhood, right? What kind of parent do you think you will be? What is your parenting philosophy, if you have one? Whatever it is, you're going to really change when you have kids anyway. Obviously, what role does religion play in your life and spirituality? And how much do you want that to be part of your life? I'm dealing now with a couple where he is adamant. He does not want his kids to go to Jewish day school or yeshiva, and she does. And from his perspective, he went to public school, happened to be a very Jewish public school, and did very, very well, right? And he found that struggling public school made him who he was in order to be proud of his Judaism. And his future wife went to yeshiva, and the idea of sending her kids to public school does not even factor into her life. So how do you deal with that? That's something that needs to be discussed before you get married. Okay, how do you handle conflicts, right? Anger issues are very, very important. We'll come to that more when it comes to red flags. Okay, habit number two is work on yourself and not on your partner. What does that mean, work on yourself? Well, many people think they get married in order to make the other person better. Like, I'm perfect, right? Because, you know, it's me. I'm just beautiful and fantastic. So what I'm going to do is I'll get married because I want to help you become a better version of yourself. But we already started this talk saying, no, Ezer Kenegdo is finding someone who's going to give you resistance, right? Just like lifting those weights or being on the treadmill, that's going to push you to become a better version of yourself. There's a wonderful book called You Just Don't Understand, on intimacy and relationships. And it says that intimacy is the key in a world of connection where individuals negotiate complex networks of friendships, minimize differences, and try to reach a certain consensus in order to highlight differences, in order to work on them. Okay? So whether or not you realize the full potential of an intimate, joyful, lifelong union depends not on finding the perfect mate, but on your willingness to acquire knowledge about yourself. And whenever I sit down with couples, because I always sit down beforehand and make them take courses and study before I perform the marriage, before they get married, right? There needs to be preparation. I always tell them to really find out about yourself. What do you want? Who are you? Because whoever you are, you're going to bring into that marriage. You better figure this out now. You'll have plenty of time to tweak it. And no one gets married as a perfect specimen. Okay, marriage is there to help you develop and grow as an individual. So part of finding out about who you are, about working yourself, you should ask yourself, am I honest? Am I open to see myself as I am? Am I self-disciplined? Am I patient? You know, I always say to couples, whatever traits you have before you get married, they become extreme once you get married, right? So if you have a little anger issue before you get married, it's going to become a very big anger issue, right? Once you get married. If you're a giving person before you get married, you become extremely giving, right? The potential for chesed becomes multiplied greatly, because let's think about it. Marriage is basically voluntary work. That's why I tell all young people who are not yet married, irrelevant of their age, you need to spend 1 hour a week, even half an hour, doing voluntary work. I don't care what it is. Some work, you're a complete chesed, no money being given for your services, no recompense, just selfless giving. Helping a nephew with a homework, whatever it is, I don't care. But you've got to do something voluntary. Why? Because marriage is one big voluntary contribution. No one's going to pay you to get the garbage. No one's going to pay you to clean the dishes. They may not even thank you for doing it. Therefore, in order to prepare that muscle, right, that giving chesed muscle, that's a one-way giving, my friends, you're going to have to work on yourself before you get to that point. Really, your life, as I like to say, is divided into two parts, PM and AM, pre-marriage and after marriage. Everything that's ever happened to you, every occurrence, every relationship, really everything is there to help you prepare yourself for this life of marriage and being a parent, and to attain it, and then afterwards to maintain it. That's how we see life. Not before and after your first job, before and after your first $1 million, before and after law school. That's how we're meant to see life. You should ask yourself, do I put things in perspective? Can I distinguish between what's more or less important in life? Am I responsible? Am I realistic? Do I want to grow as a person? Am I sensitive? Am I a giver? These are things you need to sit down with your advisor, your mentor, we'll talk about later, in order to figure about yourself. There's room for improvement. And that's what marriage is ultimately going to be doing. Okay, we're short of time. So I'm going to go through the habits. We'll talk more about these in the future. Habit number three is you have to realize that no one marries someone perfect, except my wife. But besides her, no one marries someone perfect. They did a study, actually, from Rutgers University. They have a lot, this guy called David Popenoe. He has the Rutgers University National Marriage Project Survey. He brings it every year. I have a bunch of these from over the years. And he asked a number of participants whether they're looking for their soulmate. Who's looking for their soulmate? And if you ask any audience of young people, 99% of them, even all of them, put their hands up and say, me, Rabbi, I am looking for my soulmate. And this idea of a soulmate is a Jewish idea. Having a zivug, or the more commonly used expression, a besheret, is there someone you are destined to marry? Okay, so it's a big discussion whether there is one person. There are certain rabbanim who tell us, Chazal tell us, maybe more than one person. It depends where you are in life, or what stage in life, maybe what age in life. The idea of having a person, we know, for example, that Yaakov Avinu was destined to marry Rachel, and Esav, his twin brother, was destined to marry Leah, Chazal tell us. And we know that a voice comes out at some point, a bat kol, and says it's the child of this one for the child of that one. So there do seem to be certain hints in the rabbis that tell us that there could be one person you are meant to be marrying, right? And this actually is expressed in the spiritual world somehow at some time. The mistake that most people make is that if you do find your soulmate, everything's going to be great. Well, this is my soulmate. I have a soul, and this is the mate. Nothing can go wrong. Well, first of all, just because you have a soulmate, if you have one, doesn't mean you're destined to going to end up marrying them. Esav did not marry his soulmate. His soulmate was meant to be Leah, but he opted out, which is why Yaakov Avinu had to marry two sisters, Rachel and Leah. This was before the Torah was given, so it was permitted at that point. However, just because you think you found your soulmate doesn't mean everything's going to be fantastic. Right? You're going to float around in your pajamas. A person can argue with their soulmate. A person can make great mistakes when it comes to being with their soulmate. And even Chalila, a person can divorce their soulmate. Just because you found your zivug doesn't mean everything's going to be. Once again, let's go back to our premise of our discussion today. Your soulmate isn't the person who's going to make you happy and it's going to be fantastic and no problems in life. It's the person who's going to help me become the best version of myself. That's what we're going for. This image of two people meeting, right, and their eyes lock across the room, right, whether it's the wedding or the bar mitzvah, whatever, and they see each other, and suddenly all the smoke kind of like splits, and they look at each other, and he's like, are you? And she's like, uh-huh. And she's like, are you? And he's like, uh-huh. And they run towards each other, they embrace, and they float off into the distance, right? Complete and utter drivel. A more accurate depiction would be they meet each other, everything's fantastic, the smoke splits, and then she's like, you know, you're 20 minutes late. What have I told you about being late? He's like, where's the unconditional love? Where's the respect? Where's the honor? She's like, I told, please, can you just work on your time? We have things going on. We got stuff to do. And it'll come to me in their first year of marriage. And like, I don't know, while we were dating, everything was so wonderful. She was so loving and she was so caring. And then we got married, it all turned around. I'm like, because now you've entered into a relationship. Dating wasn't real. That was just trying to establish something. There are signs when you are dating which should help you try to figure out whether this person's going to be the best wife and mother, this person's going to be the best husband and father. That's what we're trying to figure out in the end. Okay, and there's a lot that goes into that. But ultimately, just thinking that everything's going to be great, even if you do have the merit of finding your soulmate and you're never going to argue or get angry, is non-realistic and incorrect. Okay, habit number four. I don't know how long I have. Rabbi Shore, you can just throw in the chat and let me know. I have another 20 minutes or so. Habit number four is watch out for an abusive person. This has become a big one, my friends. And I have a million things to say on this. And I have a long list of what I call red flags that people need to look out for in a relationship. From all the weddings that I've done, thank God most have ended up going full distance. Some have ended in divorce. But anyone I've spoken to who's ended up in divorce, I have found that most of them will say to me, not all, that they saw certain problems while they were dating, but they overlooked them because they were in love. Okay, which is why I started this discussion by saying something not so PC, which is try not to fall in love while you're dating because you're looking for clarity and it can cloud your judgment. But they always say, I saw certain things, but, you know, and I just kind of pushed them aside. And I knew that he was dealing with things a certain way, and they just kind of ignore them. Don't ignore them. Not every red flag is a reason to break up. Some red flags you can live with, right? It's not a contradiction. There are certain red flags, my friends, that are livable. But some of the red flags are deal breakers. And it's not always so simple to know the difference. I'm dealing with a lot of people who are married to narcissistic individuals. And if that person's a real narcissist, they always saw signs of it while they were dating. And living with a narcissist or someone who's bipolar as a diagnosis, or someone who's got borderline personality disorder, which is much worse. I don't know if there's any treatment for that per se, but these things need to be looked at and investigated with a very clear mind and a mentor before you get married. And certain things to watch out for. Again, this is just a general list. I'll just throw it out. Is this person controlling and possessive, right? While you're dating, they keep tabs on you the whole time. How do you spend your money? Who do you spend your time with? And they're constantly like messing you. Where are they? What's going on? And many people are flattered by this, but that could be a red flag. Like normal people want to spend time with you, but respect your independence. Some people have Jekyll and Hyde personalities, right? One minute, at the beginning, we all see each other's good sides. First, second, third day, everyone's on the best behavior. You look good. You smell good. You're opening doors. You're being kind and considerate. But eventually, if you date properly, and I mean that sincerely, with the correct vision, you'll see that there are certain traits that come out. I mean, how do people, while you're dating, how do they treat people who are, quote unquote, lower down on the totem pole? Excuse the expression. But how do they treat a waiter in the restaurant? How do they treat the guy in the parking lot? Right? Are they, hey, where's my, right? Excuse me, did you, right? Make no mistake. Any traits you see while you're dating, you're going to end up dealing with while you're married to them. Because at some point while you're married, you're going to end up lower down on the totem pole. So don't disregard those small moments while you are dating. Is this person hungry and power hungry and manipulative? Right? These are things you have to look out for, right? Do they display great interest in how much money you or your parents have? Now, I have a whole talk online already on dealing with in-laws, okay? That's a whole big topic. I am always dealing with in-laws, unfortunately, who are dealing with their stuff with each other and end up fighting through their kids. That's a whole thing. But you know the expression, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree? In many respects, that is very, very true. And you'll learn a lot about person. But by the way, just because they have wonderful, just because you have they have wonderful parents doesn't make them fantastic, right? I see many people who come from wonderful families and become very selfish, annoying, abusive individuals. So that's not always a key to success, but there's a lot there, right? And their relationship with them, and are they willing to hold them in a certain way in terms of the relationship and take your side rather than theirs? These are very big, big things. Are they able to empathize with you and with other people, right? Are they compulsive, make unrealistic demands? Are they arrogant? Are they paranoid? Do they lie to you? Are they deceitful? Do they minimize important things in your life? All these things and many more are things you need to be looking out for while you are dating. Of course, are they physically or verbally aggressive? is very, very important. Okay. And do they have a history of substance abuse and medication? These are things we have to try to figure out. You're not always going to get complete clarity. And there's a strong element of faith. I will mention as a side point. I didn't mention something which I should have. And that is prayer plays a big, big role when it comes to dating, relationships, marriage, and kids. It's not a coincidence, my friends, that the longest tefillah, the longest prayer in the Torah, that's printed as in a person, and you actually see the entire prayer tefillah they make is Eliezer trying to find a shidduch for Avraham Avinu's son Yitzchak. Now, why Avraham Avinu didn't go himself is an interesting question. Why he sent his trusty servant Eliezer? Obviously, Avraham felt he'd be too noger davar, right? Too intimately involved in order to have a certain distance in order to find the right person. But Eliezer prays, and that prayer is printed. It can't be coincidence. Tefillah and shidduchim are very closely connected. I have a number five. I have another few minutes. I'll just finish off. Don't let your love be dependent on things. It's actually a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot from chapter 5, Mishnah 19. That when your love is dependent on a thing, whether it's money or good looks or objects or whatever, on external factors, when that thing goes and ultimately it will go, the love will go as well. However, if, says Rashi, your love is based on your heart, says Rashi on his commentary on Pirkei Avot, it establishes a profound principle of ahava. And we mentioned before, if not today, in the past, that the word for love is ahava, and the root of that is hav, means to give. Ultimately, marriage is going to teach you to become a selfless giver. And you've got to get into that mode of giving before you enter into that world. Number six is you have to make a realistic list of qualities you're looking for in a partner. Okay? And I tell people to literally make a list, right, of must-haves, important to have, and bonus. Okay, what's a must for me? What's important? What's a bonus? Right? Must be from, you know, a family just like mine. Well, maybe that's important. Maybe that's a bonus. Right? Must have a great income. Maybe that's a bonus. Maybe it's important. Right? We need to figure this out, because when we think about what we want in a life partner while we're dating, everything's a must have. No. And a must have for a 20-year-old is very different from a 25-year-old, which is different from a 35-year-old. Things change and we develop and we evolve. Okay? And finally, appoint someone as your mentor. Okay? We know that Avraham Avinu was very, very careful to find someone outside of his immediate family, Eliezer, in order to create a marriage partner for his son Yitzchak, to find the right zivug. And it's true for us as well. And many commentators speak about this, that we are too enmeshed sometimes. And I say to young people as well, you can go to your parents for guidance. In most cases, they are wonderful, amazing, but sometimes you have to go outside, whether it's a counselor, therapist, Rabbi Rebbetzin, or someone who's in a good relationship. This is important in order to find someone who's outside. We'll finish with the words of Rabbi Samsonfeld Hirsch, when he says, Jewish marriages, most Jewish marriages, are contracted not by passion, but by reason and judgment. And God willing, there'll be a loving marriage and a loving relationship, but one of ahava, that will grow and blossom as you become a better version of yourself. Together with your spouse, you turn the I into us and me into we, and create a life of giving together with the right guidance, which we all need before you get married and after. Especially, I'll just say, the first year, Shana Rishona, is so important. Shana Rishona, my friends, are the roots to the tree of your marriage. If the roots are strong, later on, if a strong wind comes, it may blow a branch off, but the tree will still stand. But if that first year is not strong, your roots are not strong, but it will look like the tree is strong, a wind will come and will blow the entire thing over. Today, my friend, Shana Roshana takes 5 years. I've heard from Rabbanim, maybe 10 years. My blessing is that each and every one of you, God willing, whether you're in the parasha Shidduchim yourself, or trying to find a life partner, or you're advising other people, hopefully you are, you should find your zivug hagun and you should build a beautiful bayit ne'eman b'Yisrael. Thank you so much.